In Petrograd, soldiers mutiny, determined not to be sent to the front. It ignites the biggest threat yet to the new government.
So what sparked it off is the attempt of the government to try to move troops out of Petrograd as part of this offensive. And the masses say, that's a line in the sand, we're not going to cross it, we're going to stop you from doing that.
They take to the streets, demanding that power be transferred to the Soviets.
The problem is that nobody else is ready to lead them or to carry out that fight. There could easily have been a July revolution. Nobody could have saved the provisional government from the Kronstadters and from the demonstrations of July. They could have just walked in and arrested the provisional government, but they had nothing to put in its place.
The demonstration was to end tragically. In the heart of the city, provisional government troops fired on the protesters from the rooftops.
The July days appears to be the radicals overstepping the mark. So the government cleverly begins to turn this to its own advantage by saying, we have papers to prove that Lenin is being financed by the Germans.
Lenin is branded a German spy and a traitor to his homeland. Orders are issued for his arrest.
Lenin himself immediately goes into hiding out of reach of the provisional government. But the Bolshevik party simply carries on semi-underground.
Using a forged passport in the name of Ivanov, he fled to the north. He went to ground in Razliv, only 20 miles from the violence of the capital. And here, using a sawn-off tree stump as a writing desk, he weighed the chances of revolution.
Our membership has more than doubled since April. The army is demoralized, and the peasants are increasingly turning towards us. The government is divided and ineffective, and all the groups except our own are wavering. Bourgeois revolution will pass into the revolution of the working classes. It will happen. Not today, or tomorrow, but very soon.
At Moscow's Bolshoi Theater on August the 12th, the provisional government made a desperate attempt to rally the drifting forces of the country and create some feeling of unity. An all-party meeting was convened to discuss a way out of Russia's dilemma. And more than 2,000 delegates arrived to fill the stalls and balconies of the theater. They were intended to represent every group in the whole unhappy chaos of Russian society and politics. But the Bolsheviks were not among them. They boycotted the meeting, called a strike on the day of the conference, and accused the delegates of not truly representing the people. Out of the long session of empty wrangling, one strong man emerged, General Kornilov, the new commander-in-chief, who was so angered by the prevailing confusion that he took the law into his own hands by military action.
It's time to hang these German spies with Lenin at their head and disperse the Soviet. I want to move a corps to within striking distance of the capital so that when the Bolsheviks demonstrate, we can humble the traitors as they deserve.
Although forbidden by the government, Kornilov's troops advanced on the capital. Kerensky relieved Kornilov of his command, and Kornilov in turn called for the resignation of the government. And his armor moved forward towards St. Petersburg. But Kornilov had seriously miscalculated. The Soviet called on its workers and soldiers to oppose him, and they formed a militia, 25,000 strong, which later became the Red Guard of the October Revolution. Kornilov was resisted by a genuinely popular movement, and at the head of it were the Bolsheviks. Against such resistance, Kornilov's armor spent itself in vain. Those who had resisted Kornilov returned to the city, and the victor was not the government, but the Bolshevik party. Trotsky, freed from imprisonment in mid-September, was elected president of the St. Petersburg Soviet. And for the first time, the Bolsheviks had a majority in the Soviets of both St. Petersburg and Moscow. Their fortunes, so low in July, were rising fast.
In the streets, the talk is of peace and bread, neither of which Kerensky has provided.
Everybody knows that something is going to happen, but nobody knows just what.
Petrograd does not sleep. At night, the arguments grow louder, the crowds
thicken. Nobody is satisfied with Kerensky. The far right wants a strong man, the far left wants peace.
You heard Trotsky speak at Smolny. If Lenin represents thought, Trotsky represents action. He is essentially an agitator.
At Smolny was packed. At one point, someone on the platform asked the comrades not to smoke, and everybody, including the smokers, took up the cry, "Don't smoke, comrades," and then they went on smoking.
At the point, Trotsky said, "We are trying to avoid insurrection, but if the Kerensky government attacks us, we shall answer blow by blow." The audience broke into wild cheers.
Lenin is a strange popular leader, a leader purely by virtue of intellect. Colorless, humorless, uncompromising, he seems to have none of Trotsky's force of personality or his gift for phrase-making, and yet it is Lenin who is the architect.
Kerensky's some socialist, huh?
What? The Winter Palace of the Tsar, where Kerensky's government now holds office, is vast and magnificent.
It's quiet in the Winter Palace. There's no sign here of the strikes and lockouts that convulse Moscow and Odessa. No evidence that transportation is paralyzed, that the army is starving, and in the big cities there is no bread.
Kerensky is full of old-world manners and charm, totally unlike Lenin.
The provisional government will last, Kerensky said during the interview, in spite of the Bolsheviks.
In this house on October 10th, the Bolshevik Central Committee met, and by 10-2, supported Lenin's proposal for an armed insurrection.
The masses have given us their confidence, and they ask not for words, but for deeds.
In the Smolny Institute, formerly the Young Ladies Academy, the Bolsheviks organized the insurrection, and the scene was described by the American reporter, John Reed.
The Institute had been taken over by revolutionary organizations of workers and soldiers. Within were more than 100 rooms. On their doors, enameled plaques still informed the passers-by that VIN was Ladies' Classroom Number 4, or Teacher's Bureau. But over these hung crudely lettered signs, evidence of the vitality of a new order, the Central Committee of the Soviet, or Union of Socialist Soldiers. The long, vaulted corridors, lit by rare electric lights, were thronged with the hurrying shapes of workmen and soldiers, and the sound of their boots made a deep and incessant thunder on the wooden floor. The landings were heaped with pamphlets and political literature.
Everyone seemed really determined. We were thinking more clearly than we had in July, and we knew exactly what we had to do.
23rd of October, Bolshevik battalions left to take up their positions in the streets. Government suddenly found itself short of armed support. At the Smolny Institute on October 24th, the Bolsheviks made their final plans for the revolution. Their leaders were now working without sleep. In the early hours of October the 25th, the Bolshevik fighting brigades left Smolny to seize the key points in the city. The railway stations, State Bank, Telephone Exchange, the main bridge across the river. The revolution had begun. Transformed Russia and shaken the world.